instinct was to free the caged creatures immediately, but he knew that would be disastrous. Remember the Asharan. You can't just rush in and free everything you see. The argument felt unconvincing, but he checked himself, at least for the moment.
Of course! This way, please!
Kaestri led them to the far right side of the chamber, on the opposite side from the caged monsters. In doing so, they passed through a circular marked area in the center of the room. A fighting ring, most likely. Probably for pitting the monsters against one another or against human opponents. Talion wrinkled his nose in disgust. He was no stranger to violence, but keeping creatures in cages to fight for the amusement of others was something he couldn't condone. Did Ayara send me here with the knowledge that I'd be bothered, in hopes I'd do something about it? Either to get me into trouble with Kaestri or possibly to remove him as an obstacle to her? Considering the motivations of his enemies and grudging temporary allies wasn't something that came as naturally to him as it seemed to for Lydia and Jonan, but he was working on it. He had to. The world would never stop using him as a game piece if he didn't stop himself from being played. I need to focus on completing my objective, even if Ayara expects me to deviate from it. I can alert someone to the problems here, or handle them personally, after I've provided Lydia with the identity of the Shrouded One. The section of the gallery dedicated to displaying items was closer to what he'd been expecting. Small crystalline cases on pedestals held small individual objects, each of which had a plaque describing the contents. Two larger crystal sections held full exhibits of themed items. One of them held full suits of armor, and the other held a broad variety of weapons. Talion drifted to the weapon case, not because it was what he was there for, but because it was expected that he'd be interested in weapons, and he hoped to deliver on that expectation. If he showed too much immediate interest on what he was actually there to see, he knew that would drive up the owner's perception of its value. And besides that, he did actually want to see the weapons. He liked swords. There was a distinct lack of swords, sadly, at least by Talion's estimation. There were only four in the case, and only one of them had the kind of reach he preferred. The first sword was a rapier with a thin enough blade that it looked to be built for dueling or display rather than actual combat. Talion inspected the plaque below it. Sliver of Iron Rain, a relic of the Talisian Order, enchanted with protection spells to assist in the wielder's role of defending the Queen of Faludin. Created estimate 2464 VF. The current year was 3123 VF, and thus that made the sword over 600 years old. Protection enchantments might have been useful for most, but they'd never worked quite properly on him. And he'd never had much reason to be interested in the Talisian Order, so he wasn't particularly interested in it just for collector's purposes. May I? Talion asked, gesturing toward the sword.
With that one, yes!
Kaestri nodded, then moved to open the case. He reached inside, retrieving the sword, and handed it to Talion. Talion lifted the sword, flicking it in the air and giving an appreciative look.
Very light. Is that something you look for in a sword?
Talion shrugged. The Sakess is light, but no, not typically. I actually tend to enjoy heavier weapons more for the most part.
Ah, the next one is perfect then. Although I can't allow you to hold that, sadly.
Talion had to admit Kaestri was right. The next one was perfect for him. He concentrated for a moment, closing his eyes, then handed the sliver of Iron Rain back to Kaestri and turned to the next sword in the case. It was a crimson-bladed great sword that was almost 6 feet in length, close to Talion's full height. The crossguard curved upward on both sides, and the top of it was sharpened to be used as an additional cutting surface. Impractical, given the length, Talion considered, but I do like the aesthetic of it. Given that and the weapon's size, Talion expected it was designed to be used by someone with great enough strength to wield it as a crushing implement against armored foes, rather than just as a traditional slashing and cutting sword. The most interesting part was the pommel, which contained a large red crystal, not dissimilar from the blue one in Talion's own weapon. Gems like that were often the power sources for ancient sorceress weapons, but he'd rarely encountered ones other than his own. World Cutter, a Dominion-marked greatsword once used by Vanden Kay, one of the supposed gods of the continent of Tyrenia. According to legend, it was forged with the heart of a star from metal in the depths of the elemental planes. It is considered the most successful attempt to replicate the Dominion Breaker, the sword crafted by the World Makers to protect our world from outside threats. Like the Dominion Breaker, the World Cutter has abilities designed to combat divine opponents, though they function differently. While the Dominion Breaker utilizes a single unknown dominion to detonate essence, the World Cutter channels the power of dozens of different dominions simultaneously. This unique mix of energies causes it to shimmer like a rainbow and allows it to exploit the vulnerabilities of nearly any opponent. Unfortunately, it is so heavy that no ordinary human or Rethri can even lift it. Creation date unknown. Talion tilted his head to the side.
I bet I could pick that up. And it's built for fighting divine enemies.
He shook his head at himself. Dominion-marked swords were unfortunately not what he was actually there for, as much as he might have been interested in them.
I can see you like that one, and with good cause. It's one of the three most valuable items in my entire collection. Sadly, due to the risks, I can't allow you to pick it up. It's quite volatile and powerful, not unlike your own sword, from what I'm given to understand.
That makes it even more interesting. Still, I don't really need another sword that's difficult to wield. Talion gave Kaestri a nod, then turned to the next sword. It was a gold-hilted saber, with the blade visibly glowing with matching golden light. The Descent of Twilight, a weapon said to have been once wielded by Valian himself, long before his acquisition of his more famous great sword. The Descent of Twilight is enchanted with both light and shadow, possessing capabilities related to both. With light, it can strike at distant foes with blinding speed. With shadow, it can conceal the wearer or ebb the strength of enemies. Creation date unknown. Kaestri reached into the case and removed it, allowing Talion to test it in the air. Once again, Talion felt the weight of the weapon, giving it a considerate nod.
Not bad. I somehow doubt Valian would approve of a paladin carrying it, though. I won't tell him if you don't, Kaestri said with a wink.
Talion laughed. He concentrated on the sword for another moment, then handed it back to Kaestri. He moved on to the last sword, which had a broad and curved blade. More interestingly, the blade was black, with such an intensity that he couldn't tell if that was a property of the material or some sort of sorcerous effect. Void Branch, the sword of a Zixian princess, recovered after her defeat in the Siege of Velthrin in 2730 VF, after being retrieved by a Thorngard captain who helped force the princess into retreat. The Void Branch was passed down through his family for several generations, before eventually being sold to cover the family's gambling debts. From there, it passed into the hands of a master thief, who was not masterful enough to steal from Lord Kaestri's vault. The weapon nullifies all nearby sorcery and cleaves through both sorceress and physical defenses with ease. Creation date unknown.
That was an intriguing weapon, potentially even more useful than the World Cutter.
While the World Cutter sounded more impressive, the functions and legends of the weapon had likely been greatly exaggerated. In the case of the Void Branch, however, the visible aura of sorcery around the weapon was enough confirmation that it had at least some of the functions described. Void sorcery was extraordinarily rare and difficult to use, and from the sound of it, it also had some sort of secondary enchantments for cutting through armor. Ruin sorcery, perhaps, or maybe even metal sorcery like his own. While he didn't think he'd enjoy wielding the weapon in its present form, perhaps he could reshape it.
See something you like? Lord Kaestri asked.
Talion pointed at Void Branch.
I always appreciate enchanted weapons, and this one looks fascinating. May I test it?
Not that one. My sincerest apologies. I should have expected you to gravitate straight to the swords, of course. I do have a few more that aren't on display, if that's what you're here for.
That's sorely tempting.
Talion turned to Kaestri. I haven't made up my mind about anything specific, but swords are always of interest to me. I'd be thrilled to see any other weapons of note in your collection, but we'll have to see if I have anything left to trade you after I've perused what you already have on display. Kaestri smiled.
Of course. Forgive me for interrupting. Take your time and look around.
Thank you. Talion turned back to the weapon display, focusing on the next best thing after swords, pole arms and spears. The first was a broad-bladed halberd. Valyrian Legion Halberd, a halberd used by Lieutenant Commander Corey Wolfe of the 4th Valyrian Legion during the final battles outside the capital of Zixis. The weapon has been preserved in the condition in which it was found. Forged estimate, 3055 VF.
That one's not Dominion marked, Kaestri explained, but perhaps something of sentimental value to many. Perhaps a good replacement for your old friend's shield?
Talia nodded at the logic. Definitely worth considering. I'd like to bring him back something if I can, but my priority is on enchanted goods.
Of course! I would expect nothing less.
After that, Talion examined a massive two-handed hammer with a head that was constructed entirely out of glimmering white crystal.
Envamir, the hammer that broke the spine of the world. This weapon requires little introduction, for it is well known in myth and legend. Envamir was the weapon wielded by Coronir, the god of strength and stone, as a mortal man. The weapon's title comes from his use of the hammer to collapse an entire mountain range, preventing the escape of the buried from their prison deep underground. The shaft was broken in the process of this great feat, and the current shaft is a replacement. The hammerhead, however, is the original. Upon ascending to godhood, Coronir gifted the weapon to his high priest. It was passed down throughout the priesthood until the final battle against Zixis, at which point the weapon was lost in the siege.
Talion's eyes widened at the description, and for a moment his gaze shifting to the intricate golden pommel in the shape of the lion's head, then moving upward to examine the four glowing runes on each side of the hammer. It certainly met the description of Coronir's legendary weapon, but of course he knew it was more likely to be a replica. Is this how everyone feels when they see the Sekes? The same skepticism mixed with awe?
Something of a personal favorite, that one, Kaestri explained. One of the few that can be very directly traced to being used by a member of the Taos Pantheon, much like your own weapon. Normally I wouldn't consider parting with it, but I was hoping that perhaps you'd be interested in trading a sword for a hammer.
Talion shook his head. Well, I appreciate the offer. My sword has a bit too much sentimental value.
A pity.
Kaestri shook his head.
Ah, well, there are plenty of other things to look at.
The next item looked something like a spear or glaive, but with something more like a pointed crossguard near the bladed portion at the top of the shaft. The two additional points on the guard made it almost resemble a trident, but they weren't quite long enough to call it that. The Three-Thorned Rose. A spirit-imbued glaive from Artinia Dyrtal. In spite of our best efforts, the exact functions have not been able to be identified. According to the traveling merchant who sold it, the weapon is a relic of House Diamond, once used in many battles in their legendary tournaments. Forging date unknown.
Rin looked at that weapon with interest.
That's not a glaive. It's a yari.
I'd forgotten. You spent a bit of time in Artinia, did you not?
Kaestri smiled.
Perhaps you could help me discern the function. I confess it's proven all but impervious to conventional identification spells.
Rin narrowed her eyes at the object.
You don't want anything to do with that weapon. And it's not a House Diamond relic. It's of the buried.
The buried?
Kaestri frowned.
You're certain of that?
Rin stared at the item for another moment, then gave a soft nod.
I'd get rid of it as quickly as possible. Honestly, you might wish to have Talion here destroy it for you.
Talion turned to Rin. Wait, are the buried still a threat? I thought the gods handled that thousands of years ago.
Nothing to worry about right now.
Rin took a breath.
I'll explain some other time.
I'll have to consider this problem, Kaestri sighed. Perhaps I could get you to take a look at my other Artinian purchases. It's so hard to get anything from there that I just bought everything I could.
Rin nodded.
That's because selling spirit-imbued items to foreign nations is almost entirely illegal. The traveling merchant you spoke to was more than likely someone on the run from the Empire. You're fortunate that the presence of these things hasn't brought you any Artinian interest.
My, that would be troubling. What about this?
Kaestri pointed to one of the object cases nearby, and Talion tore his attention away from the weapons to follow Kaestri's gesture and look. Artinian Soul Diamond. This diamond is said to be imbued with great spiritual power. If properly utilized, it can increase the strength of the spirit of the one who uses it. Creation date unknown.
Rin looked at the object intently again, then nodded.
It's real. I'm a bit surprised. That's a valuable find.
Could you, perhaps give me an estimate of the value, purely as a favor to a colleague?
Kaestri seemed abashed. Rin chuckled.
Open the glass. I'll need to touch it to evaluate the amount of spirit inside.
I suppose that would be acceptable.
He reached forward, touching a rune on the glass and whispering a word. A section opened, allowing Rin to reach inside.
Not bad. She pulled her hand back. It's nearly a tenth full, which given the size and the cut, in Artinia, something like this would be worth a small fortune. Unfortunately, it's very nearly worthless here, save for symbolic value. The authority can't be invoked properly here, so you can't make use of the spirit inside.
Rin wrinkled her nose.
Maybe with a powerful spirit sorcerer, you could do something with it.
Kaestri folded his arms.
I seem to recall that you are a powerful spirit sorcerer, Lady Jaden.
Guilty.
A wry grin crossed her face.
But I don't offer my services lightly, especially considering the risks of making a mistake when working with an item like that. It could tear my spirit to pieces.
You can spare me the theatrics. I'd be interested in moving the spiritual essence in there into someone, perhaps myself. What would you charge for such a service?
Rin winked at him.
I haven't found anything I like that much here yet. We'll see.
Kaestri grunted, leaning toward Talion.
Be careful with that one. Feed her too much and she'll bite your hand right off.
Now that's hardly fair of you, Corus. Hands are one of my least favorite foods.
Rin turned to examine the other miscellaneous items and Talion moved back to the weapons. There were a few more in the case, but none of them were quite as tempting as the World Cutter or the Void Branch. There was a dagger with a lightning enchantment that the plaque claimed to originate from Rendalir, a fire-imbued axe said to have once been used by a Zixian general, and a single arrow said to have once been fired by one of the old gods that predated the Taos Pantheon. There were 3 full suits of armor in the armor case, but Talion was less interested in those, at least at first. He did see one particular item in the case that caught his eye, however. Silver weave tunic. This shirt is woven from silver weave, a form of metallic thread woven by the silver weave spiders of Caldwin. While metallic, it is nearly as light as conventional cloth, and nearly impossible to pierce or cut with ordinary weapons. It is not enchanted, but offers better protection than many enchanted suits. Creation date unknown.
How much for the tunic? Talion asked.
Ah, you have an eye for quality, I see.
Kaestri grinned.
I'm afraid you'll have to be the one that makes an offer, however. You're going to need to give me more than what I could expect to make at the auction, otherwise it would be foolish to sell it now.
Talion nodded. I'll think about what I'm willing to offer. I don't suppose you'd be willing to compensate me or offer me a discount if I help you dispose of the 3-thorned rose.
I'll consider that at some point, but not today. It hasn't caused me any trouble in the months that I've had it, so I don't believe I have any need to hurry.
Kaestri gave Rin a questioning look.
You're right. It isn't that urgent. Rin frowned. But I wouldn't wait forever either. The Yari will attract attention eventually, and not of a kind you'd like.
Kaestri nodded seriously.
Very well. Have you found anything you're interested in, Lady Jaden?
Rin pointed at a case.
Maybe. Could I trade you something for this?
Talion looked over and realized Rin was pointing at the case containing the item he'd come to look for. It was a silvery mask that covered the upper half of the face with a single clear rune on the forehead. The Mask of Kishor. Once the mask worn by Kishor the Artisan, one of the gods of the destroyed world of Rendalir. It is one of very few artifacts that escaped the destruction of that planet, most likely due to its enchantments, which assist the wearer in avoiding detection sorcery and identification. The mask is also notably resilient to damage. Talion watched the conversation, hoping that Rin was asking for his sake, and not in an effort to buy it out from under him. He doubted she would make that kind of move, but he couldn't be certain.
Ah, that one might be a bit of a problem.
Kaestri shook his head.
I'm afraid I wasn't planning to put that up for auction. I don't trade items from Rendalir for anything but other items from Rendalir, since they're so rare. In truth, part of the reason for the auction is so I can purchase more items from there.
Rin leaned a little closer to the box.
Interesting. Don't think I have any toys from Rendalir to trade, she turned to Talion. What about you? Maybe we could do a two-part trade. If you have something he wants, you could trade me the mask for one of the swords you liked in my collection.
She hadn't offered him any swords, so the intent behind her remark was clear. Talion reached into his bag, retrieving the crystalline necklace that he'd shown Rin earlier. Arturo's Amulet of Sanctuary. You've heard of it, I assume? Kaestri's eyes widened momentarily.
That,
he regained his composure after a moment, shaking his head.
Was anything else with it? Any people, perhaps?
Talion hesitated. Kaestri seemed a little too interested. Far more than he should be for something that was an ancient relic from a ruined world.
Nothing else,
Rin said for him. He didn't correct her. If she didn't think it was wise to mention the map, she probably knew more than he did.
I'm the one who told him where to find it, you know.
Kaestri looked noticeably flustered now.
And where was that, may I ask?
I think we'll trade that to you along with the necklace,
Rin smiled.
For the mask?
Kaestri raised a hand and ran it through his hair, turning away.
I'll need some time to think about that,
he frowned.
I don't suppose I could trade you the lady's hour instead. I know you had an interest in it before.
Definitely still want it, but not as much as the mask.
Rin lifted a finger to her lips. Perhaps I could trade you this dagger for the lady's hour, and the amulet for the mask. Talion retrieved Sculptor from his belt, offering it to Kaestri. Kaestri accepted the weapon, turning it over in his hands, then unsheathed it.
A stone-shaping dagger? Ah, interesting. This is of Zixian make, no?
Talion nodded. A tool that once belonged to the Zixian prince, Shosen Ver. It's called Sculptor. I thought it'd be useful in your line of work.
How fascinating.
Kaestri sheathed it, then handed it back to Talion.
Unfortunately, while I do appreciate the concept of the item, it's of limited actual use to me. I would trade it for another weapon, perhaps, but not something on the scale of the Lady's Hour or the Mask of Kishore.
Talion nodded. I'd like to discuss a weapon trade later, then.
Of course.
Kaestri turned back to Rin.
Did you have a better offer for me?
I do think I know about one more item from Rendelir. Maybe we could trade you items from Rendelir for the mask and the lady's hour?
That depends on the item in question, but I'm willing to entertain it.
Kaestri's gaze showed a great deal more interest now.
What sort of item?
It's a crystal, Rin smiled. An intelligent item with powerful sorcery. I'm sure you've heard of them.
Talion turned his head toward Rin in alarm. He knew about one of those crystals, too, and it was currently in Lydia's possession.
Yes.
Kaestri smiled brightly.
Good, very good. If you truly can find one of those crystals and bring it to me, I will give you exactly what you need.
Excellent.
Rin grabbed Talion by the arm.
Let's go, Talion. We have some exploring to do.
Chapter 9. Jonan 3. Hints of Things to Come.
Opening his eyes did nothing to bring him vision. The darkness around him was immutable, at least at first, until the fires came. There was a moment of panic as the air reddened and he began to smell the smoke. He tried to move but was constrained by wood on all sides.
A coffin?
No, there's a crack in the middle. I can almost see through it. And then he knew where he was. An all-too-familiar cabinet where he'd hidden in 1,000 nightmares before this one. But usually, he wasn't quite this aware. His hands clenched.
Wake up! Just wake up! I'm so tired of this!
He pulled his arm back, ready to smash a fist into the cabinet door. Maybe he'd alert the woman outside who was murdering his family, but it didn't matter. It was just another nightmare. She couldn't hurt him more than she already had, could she? The cabinet door swung open before he could throw his punch, revealing his childhood home, ablaze with the flames that consumed his family. A woman stood in front of the cabinet, grinning brightly. She looked just the way that she had on that day. But she wasn't the one who had butchered his family.
Happy Children's Day!
She was the one who had saved him. Or saved, at least. Jonan lowered his fist, shuddering with rage.
Ayara!
His mentor winked at him, then gazed around.
Dreaming about our first meeting? How appropriate. I was going to visit you either way, but you've already set the scene so perfectly.
Jonan took a deep breath to center himself, but that forced him to inhale smoke. He let out a hacking cough, then wiped his face to clear the water from his eyes.
Change it, he managed before breaking into another cough.
Change? Oh, this? She glanced around. I suppose I am here a bit early. Did you want to play out the bit with Lavender first?
He almost swung at her, as futile as that would have been.
Get us out of here!
Oh, I suppose I can rescue you a little bit early. Come along, then.
He winced as she grabbed onto his shoulder. Then, after a moment of vertigo, they were elsewhere.
Better?
They were in a simple circular bedchamber now. It was the one where he'd spent his next several years sleeping, high in an obsidian tower in the forests near Liadra. Jonan stumbled back. It was in part because he was still nauseated from the smoke and the rapid movement, but the greater part was simply to get some distance.
Much better, he coughed again, then added, thank you.
Ayara bowed theatrically.
Of course, my dear.
Jonan groaned and rubbed at his eyes. They were still burning from exposure to the smoke.
You had something you needed that couldn't wait for me to wake up?
Can't I just want to celebrate a simple holiday with my child?
Jonan folded his arms.
You could, but it would be completely out of character for you.
How rude. You're just as bad as the other one.
The other one? You did this to Velus, too?
He processed belatedly.
I don't know if that makes me feel better or worse.
Oh, dear, don't be jealous that I visited her first. You should be jealous for completely different reasons, like that I took your hard-earned artifact away and gave it to her.
Jonan let out one more cough, then managed to look up and roll his eyes.
Is that what this is really about?
He paused, considering.
You want me to compete with her? This whole thing with discovering the identity of the Shrouded One is a test to see which of us manages it first.
That's within the dominion of possibility,
Ayara shrugged.
Or perhaps I truly need that information before the paladin gets it. And since Velus is currently wearing a paladin hat, she counts as a paladin for this discussion.
No, he shook his head. Things are never that simple with you. There's another layer to this. Maybe you're trying to use competition to make us stronger. Maybe you've decided that you only need one of us, and this will determine which. Or maybe it's something entirely different, unrelated to the two of us, so far into your chains of schemes that I can't see it.
I'm flattered you think so highly of my planning abilities, Jonan.
She clasped her hands together.
You certainly know how to make me feel proud.
That wasn't flattery. I'm just trying to figure out your current game so I have the highest chance of keeping my head on my shoulders.
Should you really be telling me what you think then, dear?
Ayara went and sat down on the nearby bed. It had seemed massive and luxurious to his childhood self, who had shared something half the size with his siblings before being taken here.
I'm tired. So tired, in fact, that I am literally asleep right now. I'm not exactly planning 10 steps ahead of anyone.
He sat down on the floor.
So, happy Children's Day. You can give me a present in the form of some straight answers.
Straight answers?
Ayara frowned.
I'm afraid I don't have any of those. All out of stock at the local stores, too. Must be in short supply due to the holiday.
Jonan put his hands over his eyes.
Fine. Give me some of your usual cryptic clues, then.
I already have, dear.
If only you'd pay attention. That got him listening. He put his hands down, turning his gaze to focus on Ayara directly.
Care to repeat them?
No, you're obviously already irritated. I suppose I'll give you something different, however, since I'm feeling generous. It would be a good time to pay attention to prophecies and portents.
Jonan wrinkled his nose in distaste.
Prophecies are nonsense. You made me write one and spread it as one of my earliest exercises in learning about rumors and belief.
Ayara smiled.
Ah, yes. The Trials of the Fateless Eight. You were nearly hanged for heresy for that one.
He managed a chuckle.
Ironic, considering who I work for. But it was effective at demonstrating a lesson. Drop a few ancient-seeming documents and locations for them to be discovered. Spread a few rumors in taverns.
Oh,
It seems you've had a revelation. A message from the gods, perhaps?
Ayara bowed her head, as if in prayer. Praise be to the Fateless Eight, saviors of us all.
Praise be to the Fateless Eight, till one by one they fall.
Ayara tilted her head back upward.
That was a rather dark prophecy, wasn't it?
Jonan shrugged a shoulder. You should have seen the earlier drafts. At least some of the children survived in the final version.
I'd like to access the restricted section, Jonan explained. I have the proper clearance.
He slid a card across the table.
It read, Jonan Kestrian, scribe in the service of Ayara, Lady of Thieves, no permanent address.
Beneath the description was a single rune etched with a mark corresponding to the Dominion of Sound. Such objects were exceedingly rare. Dominion marks were still the stuff of legends, and the idea of using them on something as mundane as a business card was almost unthinkable. But Ayara did the unthinkable often, and on this rare occasion, that worked to Jonan's advantage. Most people believed that only deities could make dominion marks, and thus a forgery would be even less plausible than the card itself. The Thorngard librarian raised an eyebrow.
What's this here?
Jonan pointed at the rune.
Touch your thumb to that to activate it.
The librarian frowned in obvious distrust.
That was a good instinct, but fortunately for Jonan, curiosity won the battle.
The librarian touched the rune.
A moment later, a woman's voice rang out. The owner of this card is my dear disciple, Jonan Kestrian, or someone who killed him, I suppose. In either case, please afford them the same courtesy you would to me. Love and kisses, Ayara.
The librarian paled, the card slipping out of his fingers.
What did you say you were here for?
Jonan folded his hands and leaned closer.
I'm doing a bit of research on a cult called the Disciples of the First. Nothing to be overly concerned about.
Unless you're a cultist.
The librarian's frown deepened. He bent down to find the card, then lifted it again carefully, as if afraid it might bite him.
I'll need to verify this, of course.
Of course,
Jonan smiled.
I'll wait here.
He could have simply told them his name and waited for someone to look him up in the directory the old-fashioned way, or even called in a favor from a Thorngard agent he knew at the base. But this was much funnier, and a good way of testing his latest trinket with minimal risk. After all the information on the card was true, even if the voice wasn't actually Ayara's. For the first few minutes of waiting, Jonan was simply bored. For the next several minutes, he was beginning to grow concerned. Within a half hour, he had several different exit strategies in mind, depending on who they sent to ambush him.
It's possible I should have brought my bodyguard, rather than leaving him at home. He stands out so much that he might have made things worse, though.
They didn't send a whole squad, at least. When the librarian finally returned, he was following behind an athletic gentleman with dark hair and a short goatee that gave him a somewhat wolfish appearance. His build and the long sword on his hip said military, but he wasn't wearing a uniform. Instead, he wore black garb that lacked any distinguishing markings. Beneath it, Jonan saw the lines of both heavy musculature and what looked like it might be a concealed shirt of chain armor. The librarian looked nervous, but the man ahead of him was confident, walking with a straight back and an affable expression. The swordsman spoke first.
Didn't mean to keep you waiting. We don't have visitors like you very often.
He turned to the librarian.
Remove any remaining library visitors, then leave and lock the door behind you. You're closed for the day.
The librarian swallowed hard, then nodded. He looked like he was about to raise an arm to salute, then stopped himself.
Of course.
The other man turned away from the librarian toward Jonan.
This way.
Without another word, he headed down another hallway.
An officer, then. Extremely unusual to see one giving orders while out of uniform. And from the librarian's expression, this isn't exactly a standard social visit. If I die here, I'm going to haunt Velis for her poor Ayara impression.
Jonan frowned and followed behind the swordsman, watching for anyone else in the library that could have been a threat. He tried to keep at least blade length away, although he doubted this would turn into a physical altercation without significant warning first. He might have been skirting the rules a little bit, but the Thorngard weren't in the business of executing people in the middle of libraries. Not typically, at least.
I didn't catch your name, Jonan tried.
The swordsman just turned his head, smiled, and lifted a single finger to his lips.
Shh, we're in a library.
Jonan narrowed his eyes, continuing to follow until they reached the library's back wall. The swordsman knocked on a section of the wall, paused, and then let out a low whistle. There was a brief grinding sound as a section of the wall shuddered, then lowered into the floor, revealing a hidden room. It was pitch black inside. The swordsman turned to Jonan and then made an after you gesture. Jonan tapped the side of his head as he walked forward, activating a dark vision spell. He wasn't going into a dark room blind if he could avoid it. As it turned out, he couldn't. There was nothing but complete blackness ahead of him, even with the spell active. Void sorcery, probably. That's about half my contingency plans down, if it's saturating the whole room. Only a few of them down if it's just the doorway, though, which it probably is.
He walked ahead, straight into the dark.
As he expected, he was through in a moment, like walking through a curtain. The room ahead was a well-lit sitting room with a table and two chairs. On the table were two teacups and a decanter of some kind. There was a single row of bookshelves along the back wall. As unimpressive as the collection appeared, Jonan knew they contained some of the most dangerous secrets the Thorn Guard had ever uncovered. In front of those shelves, there were a set of crystalline cases, like a much more fortified version of a display case for a jewelry store. The objects inside those cases were individually labeled with a name, description, and reference number. Those numbers corresponded to one of the shelves behind, which had a series of journals containing notes. In front of the shelves and cases was a line of runes visibly etched into the floor. Defensive runes, either as an extra precaution to keep things out, or, potentially, to keep things that were truly dangerous trapped inside. Looks like someone's been using this room as a place to research some Dominion-marked items of the more dangerous variety. Jonan eyed the crystal cases warily. He'd have to be cautious if he decided to examine anything inside, but they weren't what he was there for. Not immediately, at least. There were no people visible inside, but he immediately blinked his eyes and activated a spell to detect for invisible ones. No one appeared, nor did he detect any sight sorcery when he scanned for that. He stepped in further, and the swordsman followed just behind him. The swordsman whistled, and the section of the wall moved upward behind them, closing the way. There were no other doors or windows in the room. The swordsman extended a hand.
Tervis Ironthorn, I've been eager to talk to you, but we needed somewhere with sufficient security.
Jonan shook the man's hand in the classic way, clasping at the wrist. It was usually done that way to confirm that the other person didn't have a weapon in their sleeve.
Tervis Ironthorn definitely did have a weapon in his sleeve.
Jonan found himself smiling at the sheer audacity of that kind of performance.
Jonan Kestrian.
So I've heard.
Tervis made a toothy grin that only added to Jonan's existing wolf-like impression.
And you're here on Ayara's business.
It was posed as a statement, not a question.
Ironthorn. Where do I know that name from?
Tervis waved to the chairs.
Let's have a seat.
Ironthorn.
Tervis moved to a chair, sitting down and grabbing the decanter.
Tea?
Jonan sat opposite him.
Yes, please.
It's poisoned.
Tervis poured for both of them, not changing his expression.
Only mildly, though.
Jonan nodded, picking up the cup.
Is it any good?
Tervis picked up his cup, sniffed, and then took a sip. His expression shifted to pondering, then he nodded softly.
A little tart, but poison will do that.
Jonan sniffed at it as well. He wasn't an expert on poisons. He did use them, though, and he was familiar enough to recognize some of the more common ones. What he sensed was a minty herbal blend mixed with one of the uncommon ones, but fortunately it was an uncommon one that he did recognize.
Licensed tears usually are, yes?
He took a sip.
You're looking to extract some sort of confession?
Tervis's grin returned and he waved a hand dismissively.
Nothing like that. Mostly interested in your business. I might even be able to help you, depending on your angle.
Jonan sipped again, feeling coolness wash over his mind. Memory came along with it.
I'm surprised to see military intelligence taking an interest in an
issue that does not have clear connections to the Thorn God. He had initially intended to say small matter, but the poison was already kicking in. It had been years since he'd last taken the licensed tears, and longer since he'd practiced trying to resist or work around the effects. He wondered how long it had been since Tervis had taken them, and if he'd be similarly affected. Drinking the same tea certainly gave an illusion that they'd both be operating under the same restrictions, but reality was often different. Fortunately, Jonan was quite familiar with illusions, and he had some ideas on how this one worked. Tervis most likely either had some resistance to the poison or a way to cure it at will. Or, alternatively, he simply thought he was good enough at concealing his motives in a conversation that he could operate at peak proficiency, even while under the effects. That was a far more arrogant approach, but one that somehow already suited Jonan's first impressions of the man.
If you're not aware of our reasons for being interested, you must be early in your investigation. I find that surprising, given that you foiled one of their plans nearly a year ago.
Tervis leaned back in his chair, lifting his cup and very deliberately taking another sip. I wasn't aware of their involvement prior to that, Jonan admitted. And afterward, I had other responsibilities that took priority.
Tervis nodded, then gestured toward Jonan's cup. Jonan sighed and took another sip.
Would you care to share why you're so interested, then?
In time, perhaps. I'm still getting to know you. Files can be quite dry.
Jonan gave a forced smile and took another sip.
I'm afraid you have the advantage of having a file at all. Tell me, are you still working under High Guard Resve Fane?
Tervis shook his head, turning serious.
No, it's Bloodsworn Fane now. I'm taking care of many of the things he had to leave behind.
That was significant news, to the extent that Jonan would have ordinarily been quite skeptical. If it was true, it had to be recent. Bloodsworn was a position indicating that a member of the Thorngard military had been tapped to serve as the personal voice of one of the Vaykess. There were, so far as he was aware, only two other Bloodsworn currently alive. Each of them ran an entire branch of the Thorngard. It was a tremendous honor, the pinnacle of what a human could hope to earn. It was what ambitious Thorngards strived for their entire lives. And it was, in essence, a similar fate to what Jonan had been doomed to when he'd been plucked from his burning home by Ayara's hand. Ordinary soldiers were generally beneath the Vaykess's notice. A Bloodsworn was someone who would never live another day without having their every decision weighed by one or more capricious demigods who could eliminate them with little more than a stray thought. At least they had a level of authority that Jonan lacked, but Jonan didn't envy them. Bloodsworn were prone to dying even more rapidly than people with the title Silk.
I suppose I should be congratulating you on the position of High Guard, then. You must be pleased.
Tervis took another sip, staring at Jonan unnervingly.
It's a start.
A few things clicked together in Jonan's mind at that time.
There were, in general, three types of ways of reacting when someone found out he worked for Ayara.
Most people reacted the way the librarian did, meaning with a combination of terror and the immediate urge to pass off the responsibility of dealing with him onto someone else. The next category included people like the guards outside of Ayara's temporary home, the kind that would give him knowing looks and occasionally exchange stories about her strange urges and demands. They'd learned to try to manage Ayara, with long years of exposure having driven fear so deep into them that a layer of faux amusement was required to retain their sanity. Jonan liked to think he fell into that category himself. The third category was people like Tervis, the type of people who heard the name of the Lady of Thieves and saw it as an opportunity, a ladder standing just out of reach, waiting to be climbed toward the heights of power. Most failed to realize that the ladder wasn't a ladder at all, but just a series of snakes tied together and painted to look like one. From their brief encounter, Jonan had a different impression of Tervis. He saw the snakes. He'd just decided that he could handle a little bit of poison in his veins.
Well, Jonan considered, if he decides to work against me, I'll just have to make sure that there's more than a little poison on my particular rung.
Well, Jonan took one more sip, then set his teacup down. If you believe I'm underinformed about the situation, I'd like to hear what you have to offer.
Tervis nodded slowly, seeming to consider his words, then took another sip of his tea.
The disciples of the First have infiltrated a number of organizations, including our own. I do not work for them. Do you?
No.
Tervis nodded.
And you do, in fact, work for Ayara? The Lady of Thieves in specific, not just some random person calling herself that?
That was a good clarification to make, and Jonan appreciated it as such.
Yes, I actually work for the Lady of Thieves.
Good. What's her interest in this subject?
Jonan shook his head.
It's not my place to say.
Tervis gave just the barest hint of a frown.
Of course. Well, if you're working for Ayara, I believe I may be able to assist you.
He waved at the shelf.
If you're doing research, you can do it here.
And those books are?
The types of things that were too dangerous to put in something as lightly guarded as the restricted section.
Tervis set his cup down, leaning forward.
The types of things we're not supposed to know about. Blood sheeping, void calling, and more relevant to you, copies of the Holy Scriptures used by the cult you're looking for.
Jonan raised an eyebrow. What's so dangerous about a holy book? Tervis gave him another grin.
Read it and find out.
Jonan nodded, then began to stand. Tervis leaned forward, putting a hand on his arm before he could get very far.
One more thing. You'll be doing your reading here, under my observation. You will not remove any of those books from this room. Is that clear?
That seems like a very inefficient use of your time.
The grip on his arm tightened.
But yes, of course. I understand perfectly.
Tervis released Jonan's arm, then gave it a pat.
Good. Tervis stood up. I'll show you the right books, then get to some reading of my own.
What will you be reading?
Tervis glanced at the shelf, then back to Jonan.
The types of things that I wouldn't have the authority to read unless I had a reason to be in here to observe you. So, feel free to take your time.
Jonan smiled softly.
Ah, I believe we understand each other now.
You're getting there.
Tervis walked over to the line of runes, bending down and ran his finger across one of them. The runes flickered and died. Then he stood up and pointed a finger at one aged tome.
You'll want to start with this.
Jonan approached cautiously, then took the selected tome.
The Compiled Works of Eric Taran. He frowned. This is a forbidden holy book? Eric Taran writes all sorts of things.
He does. Read for a bit. You'll understand.
Jonan took the book and moved back to his chair, sitting down and flipping it open. He skimmed through the table of contents, seeing a list of historical events that he'd read about dozens of times. It was organized by year. 2950 AR. Hardigan and Theus turn the tides of war. 3090 AR. The end of the Zixian Empire. 3110 AR. The creation of the Calceris Fortress. 3121 AR. King Byron ascends to Orlan's throne. 3122 AR. The deaths of House Theus. 3125 AR. The fall of Velthrin. He paused after reading the last line. It was dated 2 years in the future.
Chapter 10. Lydia 3. Eyes Everywhere.
Lydia stood in front of a map, running her finger slowly across the surface. The map was the most recent she could find, and it was presently laid out atop the surface of a table inside the rented house that she was using as a base of operations. Her eyes were closed. Her vision was elsewhere. She saw the city from above, not like a bird. She moved too slowly, too meticulously for that comparison, and her focus was too close to the ground. It was more like she was simply hovering just above the buildings, gazing downward along the streets. Rather than flying along, she had a moment of disorientation every time she moved her finger, moving her view to a different location. The spell was simple in theory, but rare in execution. It required a combination of knowledge sorcery and sight sorcery, which were rarely found in the same individual. She hadn't had the capability to cast it even a few years ago, before she'd experienced Jonan's sight sorcery, and comprehended a fraction of how it worked. She'd figured out how to use a basic sight spell in Orlin when she needed to look inside wagons from outside. Since then, she'd had a considerable amount of practice. She still didn't have nearly Jonan's level of capability for illusion, but she'd found it much more intuitive to use sorcery to modify her own sense of sight. This spell was one of the most advanced applications she'd managed thus far. It would be taxing on her eyes for days, but it was worth it. She could not be idle while sending Velis into harm's way. While Lydia had been training with Blake Hardigan, she'd made sure that the paladins in her branch were exhausting every basic option to try to find Sterling through sorcery. They'd tracked down some of the clothing Sterling had worn, as well as the vial of poison that Velis had tricked Sterling into drinking, and used those items to try to track him. Every spell they attempted was met with failure. They believed that it was either due to the inherent spell-absorbing properties of being a Vakess, or that Sterling had simply cloaked himself in void sorcery, which he was known to be able to use. Repeated attempts were made over time, testing to see if he let down his defenses, but there hadn't been any luck. If they had some of his blood, they would have had a much better shot at bypassing his defenses, but they had never found any. That was disappointing, but it didn't mean sorcery couldn't be used to help find him. It just required a bit more active problem solving. Now that Lydia was in Salir, she was looking for him directly. She didn't expect to physically see Sterling walking through the streets, although that was possible, given that it was territory where he might be safe enough to walk openly. No, she was looking for something else. Blind spots. If someone was using void sorcery or another form of concealment, she'd see a person-shaped void, or area of void, depending on how the specific spell worked, while she attempted to use sorcery to look at the location. There was no guarantee Sterling was still in Salir at all, of course, and there also could be other people or places with defenses against sorceress viewing of their location. In fact, it was almost a guarantee, but it was a place to start, and she was tired of being idle. She lingered for a few moments each time she moved her finger, searching for the telltale marks of inky blackness that would indicate a gap in her sorceress surveillance. Over the course of a few hours of meticulous searching, she had found 18 of them.
Most of these are in Thorngard military bases. That's not surprising. Even we have a few areas like that at the Citadel. The vault, the rooms of the Arbiters, that sort of thing. Sterling absolutely could be on a military base, but investigating those will be difficult. Jonan might have more luck than I would in that regard, but I certainly can't expect him to help with something like this. The military facilities will have to wait until I've checked the easier-to-access spots.
She moved her finger back to a place that she'd marked with a dot of ink.
This isn't military. It looks like people are leaving with money. A shame I can't adjust the angle of the divination. Oh, it's probably a bank or a moneylender, possibly a pawn shop, but I don't see people carrying items in for trade.
Lydia shifted her finger again.
There's a spot of void inside this library. That probably isn't Sterling's hiding place, but I'd love to find out what's inside.
She blinked as she saw someone walk out of the void, and that someone was definitely unquestionably Jonan. He looked haggard, like he hadn't slept in a while.
Of course Jonan was in the secret void library. Where else would he be? I'm definitely going to ask him about that later, but for now...
She slid her finger one more time, finding another spot of ink.
This looks like the most likely area to start with. A single house. Not too big, not too small.
Lydia lifted her finger, blinking as her eyes readjusted, and then lifted a cloth to wipe the ink off of it. Aladir was sitting across from her on the opposite side of the table. He'd been quiet enough that she'd almost forgotten his presence, but she was grateful for it. He shut his book and set it down.
Find anything?
Lydia nodded.
Dark spots, but nothing conclusive. We'll need to take it manually from here.
Very well.
He stood up and stretched.
I'll go prepare the team.
Lydia frowned.
Make sure they're inconspicuous and keep a good distance behind us. I don't want whoever we're dropping in on to see them until it's too late.
Understood. I'll tell them to be cautious.
Aladir chuckled.
But you know, we may have picked the wrong group for that.
I know.
Lydia sighed.
But that's a risk we'll have to take.
Lydia reached into a pouch on her belt and felt the comforting presence of the green crystal.
You ready, Vendria?
Lydia gave the crystal a concerned look.
Are you well, Vendria?
Fading. Season.
She reached into the pouch and put her hand on the crystal.
Dominion of knowledge. Identify present essence composition.
Numbers flashed through her mind. Lydia winced as a throbbing pain ignited in the back of her head as the spell extracted a cost.
Vendria, your knowledge and stability dominion essence are significantly lower than when we last left the city. Have you been casting any spells?
I don't think so.
Something was draining the crystal's power then, or preventing her from regaining it properly over time.
If it was a seasonal change, perhaps nothing can be done. But why would her sorcery be structured in such a way?
Vendria, I'm going to loan you a bit of essence. Lydia closed her eyes, focusing on the crystal.
Knowledge shaping. Transfer.
She felt a wave of vertigo overtake her, but steadied herself swiftly. Taking in a few sharp breaths, Lydia rubbed her head and concentrated.
Did that help?
Grateful. Feel better. A bit.
Lydia nodded.
I'm afraid that's all I can do for now.
I think I'm fine. Remembering something. Quiet for a time.
Lydia nodded.
I'll ask you more about that later. For now, I've got work to do.
Interlude 1. Venora. Rendalier remembered.
Venora remembered Rendalier. She remembered the towering spires of Devorin, shimmering with arcane power. She remembered the students in their universities, the paladins of the Kingmaker, and the bickering of their politicians. She remembered the vast trees of the Fiachna Forest and the people who lived sheltered beneath or within their branches. She remembered the zealous piety of the Montake, with their white walls and their purification ceremonies. And she remembered when the world burned to ashes. She stood in the midst of a battlefield, walking among the wounded. She would kneel amongst them, Montake or Chin, and offer them healing, or if their wounds were too severe, a few moments of comfort before the end. This battle had a disconcertingly large number of the latter. One of the Sun Eater's generals, Akadi, had been there. The wounds inflicted by his scythe racked the body and spirit with an infectious disease, making healing nearly impossible. It was a terrible weapon, among the worst she'd encountered. She wore the robes and distinctive gauntlets of a silver gauntlet healer, a group dedicated to treating the injured regardless of their origin. They were mostly followers of Lyriel, a goddess of spirits and dreams. Venora wasn't one of them, but she admired Lyriel and her followers. And blending in was important. She had many enemies she couldn't afford to run into while she was in her current state. Not until the seasons changed, and she changed along with them. As she knelt by a wounded warrior's side, she smiled in spite of the pain ravaging her mind. With a gesture, his wounds began to knit together, the physical ones at least. War would leave scars beyond the ability of any mere sorcery to mend. She worked for hours, long past the point where exhaustion had set in. How could she not? Mere mortals were pressing themselves just as hard beside her. Harder, perhaps. The toll on her body from the use of spells had always been milder, less permanent than what humans dealt with. It was only after night had long fallen and her hands began to spasm from overuse that she finally ended her shift and told the others she needed to rest. They asked no questions. Even those that likely knew that she did not belong to their order. And with that, she wandered away into the night.
Soon,
she realized,
the change will come to me soon. Just one last night, a few more hours, then I'll be able to strike back. Or she will, at least.
In a few hours, she would cease to be her current aspect, Venora, the Heart of Spring. And she would take on the aspect of Venshara, the Fire of Summer. Then, later, Venshara would give way to their third aspect, Venlira, the Deep of Winter. Together, the three were called Vendria. But while the three shared a single existence, they shared little else. With the change of the seasons, she would be changed in mind, body, and spirit.
She would lose her nurturing aspect and persona. Her memories of Venora's life would be buried, like those of a fading dream. In early years, she resented these changes. She resisted them with force of body, mind, and power. In truth, now she welcomed this particular change. She had never before felt so powerless. Venora was a creature of empathy, of healing. She would bring rains to nurture crops or sit as a midwife for a mother who could not afford a doctor and help bring new life into the world. She would bring bread to feed the orphaned children and sing songs to ease their grief. But all around her, the world was dying. Crops burned. Mothers wept at the loss of their children, born and unborn. And there were more starving orphans than she could ever hope to feed. The world didn't need nurturing. It needed someone to fight on its behalf. And Vanshara, with her sword, her shield, and her fire, would fight that war. There was only one thing she would miss about her current form. She found him sitting on a nearby hillside, his gaze turned upward toward the stars, always looking towards something greater. Her heart leapt every time she saw him with her current eyes. When she saw him with Venshara's eyes, he would be little more than a stranger.
Tisus, she called out to him as she approached.
He turned his head downward, smiling that soft, beautiful smile of his.
Vendria, I've been waiting for you.
She ran to him. How could she not? She had only minutes left.
You're back so soon. I was worried I wouldn't get to see you before.
He shook his head.
Nothing to fear, love. I couldn't miss the chance to see you one last time. Sit with me.
She nodded eagerly, moving to his side. Her hand moved to his. He slipped his fingers into hers, holding them tight.
Cold, she thought. Strangely cold. And his scent.
Is something wrong? He asked.
It's just, how'd you get back here so quickly, love?
He smiled, reaching up to run a hand down her face.
Anything is possible with enough determination.
Tisus sounded so certain, so heroic. But his answer was a little bit too evasive.
Was it Arturo, then, teleporting you here?
An excellent guess, my love. You know me entirely too well.
She nodded slowly.
I do. Arturo is the most talented of the warriors among them, but he is no sorcerer. And Tisus would call me Venora, not Vendria.
Slowly she began to extract her fingers from his, but he wouldn't let her go. His eyes turned to focus on hers, looking hurt.
Leaving so soon?
She drew in a breath, yanking her hand away.
Something
sharp pierced her chest. He'd drawn the knife so quickly that she hadn't even processed it. Her eyes widened, and she stumbled back, hands going to the bleeding wound. Blood spread far too rapidly, and something else was spreading along with it. She grasped the hilt, hissing as a feeling of cold spread across her. Cold like the hands that she'd touched.
What gave me away?
The imposter asked, stepping over to her as she scrambled backward on the dirty ground.
You!
She couldn't focus on him. Something was wrong. A mere blade shouldn't be causing her this kind of pain. Shouldn't have harmed her at all. But she'd been wounded before, and she was far from defenseless. She wasn't a warrior. But she was still a god.
Body of diamond.
Her strength multiplied in an instant as the power of three stars flowed into her. She tore the weapon free from her chest, hurling it to the side.
Divine healing,
she commanded. The wound rapidly closed, but it left a trace of inky blackness within her. She smashed a fist into the ground. A fissure opened where she struck. The imposter jumped backward in shock, avoiding the gap, but stumbling when he landed. Venora pushed herself to her feet. No dust or dirt clung to her form. She did not will it to. She waved a hand. The would-be assassin flew backward, smashed by an invisible wave of force. He crashed into the nearby mountainside, leaving a crater on impact. Venora floated over to him, flexing her hands in the air.
You dare to...
She coughed, choking on a black substance that flowed out of her throat. Her eyes widened as pain once again blossomed in her chest. The assassin coughed too. He was on the ground below where he'd been smashed against the mountainside, his left arm snapped in twain and his entire body ragged and worn. Benora was pained to see Tysus's body in such a way, even if it was a mere fake. But it was only a brief concern. The false form of Tysus melted away a moment later. Flesh, muscle, and bone rebuilt itself as she watched in horror. The resulting creature was neither human nor god, but a vestige of a time long gone. With dark blue skin below bits of armored black carapace, it stood half again as tall as a human, with vast, eight-fingered claws on each hand. "Karna!" she spat, before breaking into another cough. Her wound had reopened. How? "Heal," she commanded. The wound closed again, but only for a moment. "What have you done?" The shapeshifter walked toward her in the strange, erratic movements that their kind favored in their natural form. It reminded her less of a human and more of some sort of insect, moving briefly, then freezing in place. It was a human idea, in fact. In spite of the creature's shark-like jaws, it still spoke with Tysus's voice. Benora shuddered at the sound of his voice coming from that, and horror filled her at the possible implications.
"They sought to forge weapons capable of fighting against the gods, and so, when we infiltrated their little group, we stole their ideas. And some of their bodies, of course."
Benora pushed herself forward through the pain of the reopening wound and the substance that still seemed to be spreading throughout her body.
"What have you done with Tysus?"
"Nothing but observe him, dear. Attacking him now would only have worsened things. But you,"
the creature raised a clawed hand,
"you would have been a problem if you were allowed to change."
"I will not be killed so easily, even in this form."
She wiped her mouth with a hand.
"Your plan has failed."
The creature scoffed.
"Killed? No, no. I couldn't possibly kill you, even with the knife."
It reached out with a hand, and the weapon floated into the air.
"And Ionel never would have approved such a thing."
"Ionel?"
"One of the other gods. Ionel the Preserver, the great librarian, lover of history, lover of her winter aspect. But he was..." She got a better look at the blade, dripping with black ichor for the first time. She saw the runes on the surface, and with horror, she recognized and understood what she was seeing.
"No, he wouldn't,"
the Karna shrugged.
"Deals were made. Apparently your shifting nature was not a good match for his..."
Benora struck. She wasn't as fast in her current form, but she was strong. Strong enough to punch the air and smash the shapeshifter deeper into the mountainside. She heard its bones crack on the impact. She didn't care. The pawn didn't matter. She rushed for the knife. She tore into the stone to find it, crushing rocks to powder. She found it just as the sun's rays began to chase away the night.
"No, no, it's too soon. I won't..."
And then she was gone. And winter, not summer, came in her place. The memories that followed were still too disjointed for her to parse properly, even with the help of Lydia's spell. But she remembered much of what had come before, and fragments of what had happened after. There were so many memories to sort through. Times of joy with Tysus at her side, her hero, her champion. A mortal that hoped to lead humanity against the Sun Eater, once a creator of Rendalir, now turned toward its destruction. Tysus had failed, and so had Vendria. The Sun Eater's followers had spread across the world like a plague. Creatures of shadow and spirit, ruin shades, had sundered the souls of humans and gods alike, then taken their bodies and worn them like suits. She hadn't seen the end herself. She'd only felt it. She'd been trapped in that form, her winter aspect. She'd been tricked, chained, and bound. And she'd been shattered apart, just as Rendalir itself had been.
"I was a goddess once,"
Vendria remembered. But that was long ago. Her world was gone. Her people long dead. Her champion, she didn't know. But she had to assume that Tysus had been lost along with the rest of the mortals of her world. The Sun Eater reigned triumphant, and she, now she was nothing but a stone, a sorceress curio in a world that was not her own, a mere fragment of her former self. And of the other fragments, she didn't even know where she could begin to look or how.
She didn't have eyes to see. She didn't have eyes to weep either. But she did have her mind. And thanks to Lydia, she remembered who she once was. She knew what she had to do.
I failed one world already. I won't fail another. I'll be ready when the Sun Eater arrives.
Chapter 11. Lydia 4. The Scholar. Lydia and Aladir walked side by side, trying not to look too conspicuous as they scanned the streets of Salir for any potential threats. It was a slow walk. Even after nearly a year of recovery, Lydia still relied heavily on her cane for walks of any significant distance. She could walk without one, but only with great difficulty. The back of Lydia's mind still burned from loaning Vendria essence, but the fresh air was helping. She couldn't recall ever wandering a city that felt this pure before. Velthrin was a lovely place, but walking the streets of Salir felt more like being in the midst of the wilderness. She could smell the scents of pine and blooming flowers, and more distant, the scents of spiced meat and vegetables cooking in many of the city's famed outdoor restaurants. Her stomach grumbled, but now was not the time for food. It was a city of greens and browns, with bushes and trees lining every road, and many homes painted with forest tones to match. She wished she could have simply taken the time to stroll peacefully through, but Lydia saw a place for a hidden assassin in every tree and large patch of shrubs. She reassured herself with the fact that concealing assassins was hardly necessary. If Sterling wanted to get rid of her here, he could simply have her arrested. The Vakes had near absolute authority in the entirety of the region. Lydia was the one that had to act with subtlety here, not him. Extracting a Vakes from one of their strongholds would be a complicated affair. She had plans, but even those plans had variables she couldn't account for. She needed more information. The house they arrived at was easy to identify purely through contrast to the surrounding area. It was built in an old-fashioned style. The paint a mix of grays and whites, but with only blackness visible within the windows. Civilians seemed to be avoiding the side of the street where it stood, but they weren't going so far out of their way that she suspected an immediate threat. There was enough side streets that if the house had a reputation for being terribly dangerous, people would have just gone around it entirely. There was a waist-high wall and a gate outside the house, but the gate was unlocked. Lydia swung it open and headed for the front door. You certain this is wise? Aladir clenched and unclenched his hands, obviously nervous.
No, but it's the most expedient approach. I need answers, and we have contingencies if things go badly.
Aladir gave her a curt nod, but looked unconvinced.
Ready when you are.
I am also ready, Lydia.
Thank you, Vendria. Don't exert yourself unless you need to.
You needn't worry about me. I will protect you and myself.
Something about Vendria's response was different from usual, a bit more coherent and tinged with something else. Determination, perhaps? That was a positive sign, if it was so. Most of the time, the stone merely seemed confused, lonely. She'd investigate further when she didn't have more pressing matters to attend to. Perhaps she'd found a good memory to latch onto. Perhaps that mind-linking spell that she'd found could help, but it had risks. She'd planned to try a few more options before resorting to that. Lydia reached the door, raising a hand to knock. The door opened before she had a chance.
Good day, Miss Hastings.
The man in the doorway wore white robes, belted by a knotted rope. He had no visible weapons. A white blindfold covered his eyes. He offered a slight bow, then stepped out of the way of the door and beckoned to the house within.
The scholar has been expecting you.
The way he emphasized the first two words made them sound like a title rather than a mere occupation. That gave a specific implication. Lydia froze, momentarily stymied.
The scholar? Meaning Eric Taran? Isn't he supposed to live at White Spire Mountain?
Not in this season, I'm afraid. The scholar travels extensively, and he has a number of different homes. I'm certain he can provide you with more context himself.
Lydia glanced at Aladir, who simply shrugged in response. Lydia turned back to the blindfolded man.
May I
You may check me for sorcery and weapons, yes. Also, you may take your weapons inside.
Without any further hesitation, Lydia stepped forward, putting a hand on the blindfolded man's shoulder.
Dominion of knowledge, I invoke you.
A familiar stream of information flowed into her mind, with information translating into letters. Dominion of knowledge. Dominion of air. Dominion of motion. Dominion of destiny.
You're
a seer, yes. Though not quite in the same way as the crystal oracle that you are familiar with.
He knows about Asphodel, and has similar sorcery to her own.
Lydia stepped back.
Are you the Shrouded One?
Ah, I can understand the presumption, but no. I have no connection with that organization. I serve largely the same forces that you do, albeit in a different way.
He clearly could have been lying, but even if he was, this was definitely a new source of information. She had to pursue it.
Very well. We'll come inside.
Lydia stepped through the doorway, passing the blindfolded man. She could only see a few feet beyond. The rest was obscured by some sort of sorcerous darkness effect, most likely the same void sorcery she'd detected with her earlier spell. The blindfolded man stepped into the doorway a moment later.
I'm afraid the Emerald Knight will need to wait outside.
The Emerald Knight? That's an interesting title for a Aladir. Is this oracle merely being theatrical with the use of all these titles?
Aladir reached for his sword, but didn't draw.
I go where my partner goes.
Apologies, but that will not be possible. The scholar was quite clear. No disrespect was intended, but bringing you inside would complicate matters intensely. We will return the cryptographer to you unharmed within less than an hour.
Well, it would seem my title is even stranger than Aladir's. More importantly, an hour is more than enough time to kill someone and move the body to an inaccessible location.
Lydia wrinkled her nose.
But I'm not your average someone. I'm aware of the dangers here, and I'm not a novice.
Lydia snapped her fingers.
Comprehensive barrier.
The physical gesture was entirely unnecessary. It was a clear signal that she was preparing for trouble. With that, she turned back toward Aladir.
I'll be out soon.
He gave her a grim nod, then settled his hand on his weapon.
If you're not out in an hour, I'm coming in.
Of course.
The blindfolded man smiled, then shut the door.
Shall we?
He clapped his hands. The darkness ahead of them dispersed, giving way to a perfectly ordinary-looking hallway. The walls were lined with paintings and, Lydia noted with greater interest, more than the necessary number of mirrors. The blindfolded man slipped past her, leading the way down the hall.
Apologies for the rudeness to your friend. It is too soon for the scholar to meet with the Emerald Knight.
Lydia raised an eyebrow.
Why do you use that title for Aladir? I haven't heard it before.
You will. Come.
Apparently it's not just Asphodel. Oracles are universally frustrating.
Nevertheless, Lydia followed him down the hall.
I didn't catch your name.
Ah, sometimes I forget basic niceties. Forgive me. I'm Estan.
She'd been expecting another strange title, so something as simple as Estan was a pleasant surprise.
Good to meet you, Estan.
Yes.
He nodded absently.
You may sit in the room ahead. The scholar will be with you shortly.
The hall terminated in a large sitting room with a low table in the center. A pot of liquid, presumably tea, sat on the table with teacups already laid out on both sides. There was a back exit to the house on the opposite side, leading toward a sunlit garden, and other rooms to the left and right. Estan wordlessly departed through the door on the right, then closed it behind him. Lydia examined the room further, searching at first for traps or other dangers. There were a few